The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
Welcome to Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, and on this podcast, we talk to all sorts of interesting people who live and work at the intersection of creativity and business. Our show is brought to you by Second City Works, the B2B arm of the legendary improv and comedy theater, The Second City. You can find more information at secondcityworks.com. My guest today is Kathleen Schaefer. Kathleen is a leadership coach, an author, and a public speaker. Early in her career, Kathleen was a legislative and executive government staffer in her home state of Michigan, where she co-founded the Michigan Political Leadership Program in 1992 at Michigan State University. She has taught at George Washington University, where she built its political leadership curriculum for the Graduate School of Political Management. She has authored two books, Living in the Leadership Choice and Choose to Lead. Kathleen, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Kelly.
So I was really enjoying reading your blog posts and your books, and it struck me that you have a very different take on leadership than other thought leaders in that space. So many books on leadership take a fairly hard edge on what it takes to lead. They focus on, like, unwavering decisiveness and competitive edge, very art of the war type stuff. But you were really talking about an inherent leadership ecology. Let me see if I can sum this up. This is my words, not yours, but I want to see if I'm connecting right. But that ecology requires, like, not only self-awareness, but articulate actions based on understanding that there are undeclared and unspoken reasons for why we are where we are as leaders and followers. Is that kind of a rough estimation that makes sense?
I'm impressed. You have encapsulated very well. It is a different approach, and it is fundamentally rooted in the belief that all of us have something important to offer to the world, and that the world will function better at every level of community and society when people are aware of what it is that contribute and to doing it very well.
So, you know, at the risk of cueing the sitar music, there's a lot of mindfulness inside what you talk about as being a leader. And it made me think of an improv quote that I want to read to you. Here's an improv adage, and we pulled it from the Second City Almanac of Improvisation, and here it goes. It says, keep the action on stage. Don't storytell or plan for the future. Try not to bring up the past. Try not to focus on people or animals that aren't there. It's very difficult to have a scene on when there is not a there in the now. And I think that idea of being present in the now runs through a lot of your thinking in terms of leadership.
Absolutely, because so much of what gets people out of their power is when they are focused on things that they can't control. They're always looking at, well, my boss is doing this, or I need to be here for this reason, or in politics, you know, if I, you know, do something down the road, this person or this group will come after me, instead of looking at what it is that they have to contribute in the here and now and offering it in a way that actually can be addressed and used by the people who need it most in the moment. Again, people get off, way off, because they are focused so much on trying to get things to happen that they want instead of being who they are and offering the best that they can.
Yeah, so which makes perfect sense, you know, control the things that you can control. What do you do with those? I mean, there's so much that we can't control, right? Probably most things we can't control. So how do we play out with those external forces that are difficult? Because I don't think we just ignore them, correct? You do something else.
Well, this is where the fun begins. Hmm. Because if we're always focused on what somebody else is or isn't doing, then we've given them the power over how we are operating. And much of my approach and focus came out of working with people who were running for political office. And how often they were trying to be someone that they weren't. They were trying to act like the member of Congress, you know, for the office for which they were running, and doing what they thought somebody in Congress would or could or should do instead of what they wanted to do. And every time they stepped out of who they really were, they made decisions that in the end did not serve them well, and more often than not would cost them, you know, quite a bit, if not the election.
Right. So, all right, let's talk a little politics. That's a passion of mine. And you were very involved in politics. And I'm wondering, did that hit you at an early age?
It did. I have always believed fundamentally that we have a commitment and a right as individuals to participate in our democracy and to have our government working, you know, with and for us to make our world a better place.
What was your first gig in politics?
The first, my first real experience was working for a member of Michigan's legislature, who is now Michigan Senior Senator Debbie Stabenow.
And oh, wow.
It was a wonderful experience because she was among the first generation of women who were elected in their own right, who were not, you know, a spouse or a daughter of someone to come into office. And, you know, she's been a real trailblazer for, you know, the last several decades.
My first exposure to politics was I'm trying to remember how old I was because it was the early 70s, so I might have been like 7 or 8. And my brothers decided to dress me as Nixon for Halloween. And we lived in Kenilworth, Illinois, which couldn't have been more conservative. My parents were the first Democrats to actually ever move into Kenilworth. And what this is something I love about old money Republicans is they loved it. I had the Nixon mask on. I had tapes hanging out of my suit. I think I got brought into every house that I trick-or-treated at. There is nothing like sort of old money Republicans in my mind, especially looking at the, you know, the circus that we've going on right now. You have a great quote, and I want you to talk about it because it ties together this political thing, but it ties right to leadership in business, I think, which is you can't campaign one way and govern in another. What do you mean by that?
Again, going back to my work with candidates, that there was always this prevailing sentiment that somehow you were going to have to do things on the campaign trail that would win you the office, and that once you won office, you would then somehow shift how you were operating and govern differently. Said another way is, you know, it's okay to kind of play fast and loose, or sometimes, you know, there are things that maybe don't totally align with your ethics. That's okay to do because you're trying to get into office. And then once you get there, that somehow you will, you know, suddenly come into your integrity and govern that way. And I've never, ever seen that hold true.
Right. And that seems to tie into authenticity, right? And you write about that as well. One of your quotes was, "I continue to believe that the most authentic candidate wins elections." This is a particularly fascinating election vis-a-vis what we perceive to be authentic, even if you just look at the two front runners in terms of Hillary and Donald Trump. And I was fortunate enough to be in a room with a bunch of the folks from Slate who are working on a project with the Second City. And we're at the Kennedy Center in a brainstorm meeting about what we might do or not do together. And we talked about this idea of authenticity. And the guys from Slate, and this was counterintuitive from how I'd been thinking about it, but they sort of said they don't see Trump as the authentic candidate. They don't believe he's saying the things he really thinks. They actually see Hillary as the authentic candidate because we have a book on her. We've known her for decades. They felt like she was saying who she is, whether you like that or not. What's your spin on authenticity as it relates to these people who are looking to run our country right now?
It's a fascinating set of examples with two front runners because they both are semi-authentic and in different ways.
Right.
Yes, there is a lot known about Hillary Clinton, and as I've written on fairly extensively, you know, for much of her career, she has stepped outside of her authenticity, who she authentically is, to be the candidate or the leader that she thinks she should have been. And I think the greatest example of that was, you know, her vote on the Iraq War.
Right.
You know, interestingly enough, stepping outside of her authenticity there cost her the election in 2008. I do believe she is making greater strides in that direction. And given some of the back and forth with Bernie Sanders in this primary, you know, he is being clearer about the fact that she is the establishment candidate. While she has things that she would like to change, she is about incremental change and not transformational change. And that's about the most authentic explanation of her and her views that she's ever given publicly.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that idea of being a leader and having to make the unpopular choice, which I think the business world understands that better than the political world, in my experience, because the and it makes sense, right? Because politicians have to be elected by a public, and whereas, you know, leaders in a business just need to please the board of directors. I saw there was a Adam Grant who wrote the great book Give and Take and Originals. He had posted a piece recently about sometimes you might want a leader who runs a bit contrary to your culture, because they can call out certain tics that everyone's sort of taken for granted. And at first, I had a very negative reaction, because I really believe in certainly the culture I come from, an improvisational yes-and culture where people act in agreement and allow people to disagree in a very positive way. But I also knew what he meant, because you know, sometimes you can get trapped in your own circle of thinking, and that has its own inauthenticity to it.
Yes, because what happens so often is when people are pretend to be something that they're not, it's very hard to have somebody say, hey, have you ever thought about this, or you might be missing that, or, you know, perhaps we should consider this. You know, when you are true to yourself, it's okay to have people, you know, provide other kinds of viewpoints, because you're open to it, because you know where your power source and center is. It comes from you and your leadership. What happens in so many organizations is that when people haven't truly, you know, identified who they are and become very comfortable in their leadership, they put people around them who will tell them what they want here instead of what is the truth of, you know, whether it's the market or the election or whatever. And so the idea of bringing in somebody who's kind of counterculture is like saying, yes, we need somebody to tell us the things that we're still not comfortable hearing. I'd rather get people to a point where they're comfortable with what you're describing in the improv world, the yes and, which is, I'm really good where I'm at, and I'd like to know where you're at and figure out how we can move forward together.
Yeah, that's a healthier healthier path to it. And I think the thing that maybe ties all of that together, which is the great inhibitor, which is fear, right? So why do people make these bad decisions for themselves? Why do leaders make bad decisions? Because they're acting out of fear. And you actually, I want to quote you. You say, what is the secret that keeps people complacent, willing to forego their own happiness in exchange for the promise of moving up the ladder, making more money, or enjoying more recognition? The answer is simple. It's fear.
We are more afraid of people seeing who we truly are than we are about pretending to be something and putting all of this stuff on and trying to show people that we have worth as a result of these external accomplishments or accolades.
Right.
And, you know, that's really at the core of my work, is that once you can own who you are, what you're passionate about, knowing what you have to contribute, no one can take that away from you.
Mm-hmm.
A bad review, a lost election, you know, some kind of a disagreement, it doesn't mean that you don't have worth. And, you know, it's like the old idea that you hear about in business is that you always wanted to make enough so that you could walk away from any situation, right? If you didn't like something, you could walk away.
Right.
And what I'm getting at is you don't need money to be the reason for that. It's the belief in who you are and what it is you have to offer. Because once you believe in that, you know that no matter where you go, people are going to want it. And I can tell you time and again when I have, you know, clients and others who do this, they not only, you know, experience more power and the place where they are, they wind up having people actually come and, you know, come after them because they see that they've got something that very few people have.
So that begs the question, can you be not self-actualized and be a good, effective leader?
No.
Yeah, you answered that pretty quickly.
Well, it's just so clear because when you look at what has been the downfall or the trouble behind any leader, just picture a leader in your mind who's had troubles.
Yeah.
I can guarantee you that the root of that goes back to some fear that they have that they were trying to cover up. And it happens time and again. And what is fascinating to me is the number of times that others sit by and actually watch people self-destruct. And I'm not just talking about people in, you know, political office, even in business. You know, the number of times that things happen, I mean, when you can look at the financial meltdown, when you can look at what happened with Volkswagen, I mean, all of these times when we had people who understood that things were going on that shouldn't have been, and even then people, out of their own fear, refused to speak up. And I can guarantee that it will never end well if you are operating out of fear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we don't stop becoming human beings just because we have a title, you know, when we enter the office. And I think you know, there's a great myth that exists across a lot of businesses and even in the creative arts where we want to think there's a one guy who's going to solve everything and that there's, you know, it's a great American, you know, idea, the sort of sole entrepreneur. And that rarely turns out, you know, sort of to be true. You know, you teach and you consult. And I wonder, do you have an example of someone that you look at, you know, in sort of contemporary North American business that you think is a good leader?
It's interesting because I always look at people, and of course there are lots of great leaders out there. Are there always ways that they can, you know, continue to, you know, put themselves out in a way that can be even more effective? Absolutely. When you look at, you know, some of the people who are in the tech world, I mean, I look at a Steve Jobs as somebody who masterful innovator and visionary. And yet, because of some of his lack of awareness about how he conducted himself, was, you know, alienated a lot of people around him and made it very tough for himself. I love the fact of, you know, how he was able to come back after having been fired from Apple and return to his passion for passion's sake.
Right.
I often use Al Gore as another example of someone who, you know, pursued a lot of the external trappings of power and leadership for most of his life, and it wasn't until after he sustained, you know, a major loss, and a particularly painful one at that, in the 2000 election, where he came back and lived his passion, and very quickly, you know, went on and was able to totally shift and change the dynamics around climate change. Something that he hadn't been able to do in all those years of public service.
Yeah, it's the same thing when we talk about Jimmy Carter being just one of the great ex-presidents of the United States.
Exactly. What happened with each of those individuals is that the passion was there, the awareness of how it really tuned into who they are and that ability to walk solely in their passion. And once they finally got there, you know, the world opened up for them. When they were doing it for the external rewards, it was very difficult. And I think all three of those are excellent examples of that.
You know, it ties back to perhaps to a thing that you talk about, which are the importance of understanding relationships with regard to leadership, which is not something that necessarily comes top of mind when people think about this category. And you write, you will find me working with organizations that understand we are in a relationship economy, that their greatest assets are their employees. Rarely do organizations focus on cultivating an individual's ability to engage in or be in a participant in healthy relationships. So talk to me about that. What does relationship building have to do with being a great leader?
Well, this is one of the areas that has been growing the most for me in recent years, is this whole focus on we as individuals and what we bring to our organizations is the commodity of organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And that, ask anyone who works with more than one person, and you will know that, that oftentimes the things that cause the greatest upheaval, the greatest disruption, the inability to deliver the client services or products on time, and in an efficient, productive way, is because of how people are or are not working together.
Right.
And yet, it's the piece that doesn't get focused on, because it doesn't have to do with any particular skill set. It has to do with one's ability to show up, to be honest, to engage, and to work things through in an effective way. And when people are hiding who they are, it is an impediment to productivity, period.
Right, and the thing, I think actually the technique that is probably missing with those people is listening well. And this is like a big improv thing, because we have to teach people first to understand that they're bad listeners, most of us are, and then give them real skills building in listening to not only what is being said, not just listening to hear, but listening to understand and listening for intent. And I found this Bob Sutton quote. I love Bob Sutton. He wrote, "Fight as if you are right, listen as if you are wrong."
Oh, that's a good one. And you're right. And listening is challenging for people, because if you're not comfortable with yourself and your leadership, then you're always having to keep up the facade. And when you're having to keep up a facade and you're not open, then you're focused on, you know, how am I going to respond to this? How am I going to make myself look good? How am I going to make sure my boss sees me doing this? Instead of really taking in what somebody is offering in that moment. And if that person is doing the same thing, boy, again, you've got yourself a big mess, let alone when you start bringing in, you know, groups of people to work on projects or deliver.
So I'm sort of curious, too, because, I mean, we're in firm agreement on all this. But I wonder, I mean, do you get academics or other sort of leadership gurus who react negatively to this, that are put off by the idea of something like, you know, guys, you got to be happy and you got to understand yourself to be an effective leader? Because I don't see that in a lot of leadership books.
You are correct. This is, I like to say that I'm on the edge of the inside here.
Yeah.
And, you know, pushing people in this or encouraging them to come along in this direction. I mean, what typically has been the approach to leadership is a reflection of a lot of the old vestiges of the industrialized economy, which is one person had the power and all the other people added components, you know, to help deliver something.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the technology economy that we have, everyone's got access
right.
to information. One person can't possibly know it all. And that the role of leadership now is how do you bring the best of people out?
Yeah.
Not how you tell everyone what to do. And that belief, that, and it's a very masculine dynamic of one leader with all the power, is still where a lot of the leadership ideology is focused, is because, you know, they want to be able to say, here, if you do these three things, you too will be powerful.
Yeah, and I think your point with Jobs, which is like, yeah, Jobs had a lot of issues as a leader, clearly, and a parent and all that stuff. But one thing he did, because the guy didn't write code, you know, what he did was he got a lot of different people on his team to work to the top of their ability with a vision for the product, right, which has been borne out completely, right? Who doesn't love their Apple products? They're beautiful. And this whole idea of trying to get, you know, almost no buttons on it, which seems sort of insane. Now you look at it and you're like, nope, that was genius. So that part, I think he had down pat. You know, the other stuff, not so much. But, you know, very few of us are the full package.
Right. Well, and again, with some mindfulness, those things could have been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times what happens with people who are these visionaries is that in order to push the envelope, you know, they do have to be out on the edge. And what they fail to realize sometimes is the need to bring people along.
Right.
They expect that they will simply follow. And again, that's another tripping point for a lot of leaders is that they're absolutely right in the direction they want to take us. they don't often then engage with the people around them in a way that brings them along as quickly as they could be if, you know, they were focused on that piece.
Yeah, I mean, the adage of hire people who are smarter than you is, you know, 100% correct. And then I know it was difficult for me in my career when I was in a leadership position to always think to do that, because I think there was some fear, you know, like, oh, am I going to hire my replacement, you know? But the reality is, if you are self-actualized, if you have faith in your own abilities, you don't need to worry about that, because it'll all sort of work out in the end. And that tended to be true when I was confronted with those situations myself.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, our workplaces are so locked up and arrested is because everybody's trying to defend their territory,
right,
as opposed to figure out how to work together. And what people don't always understand is that in the defense of your territory, you're actually making the accomplishment of your goals that much more challenging. When you can erase some of those lines and those barriers, it really does, you know, lift all the ships, and everyone flourishes.
So we're coming to the close of our time here, and one of the things we ask of all our guests who come on is to tell us a yes and story. What was something in your past that maybe you would have normally said no to, that you might have said yes to and left it there, but in this case you said yes and it can be a good thing or a bad thing, it doesn't matter, but it's sort of an experience that you had in your life that was your yes and moment.
The best yes and moment is for me happened when I had been starting the political leadership program in Michigan. I had been working on the very early stages of, you know, my current practice in politics and doing a lot of public speaking. And was heard by the dean of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University. At the time, I was 26 years old, and he said to me, you know, the next time you're in Washington, D.C., come, I'd like to talk with you. So I set up the appointment and walked in, and he said to me, Lowell Weicker, who was a senator, teaching a class on leadership here, and we'd like to move the, you know, curriculum in a different direction, and I'd like you to teach that course.
Wow.
And you could have pushed me over with a feather at that point.
You
know, I was barely older than most of the students in teaching, not had any experience teaching at that level, and yet it was terrifying in many ways, and yet turned out to be one of the transformative moments in my career. I wound up teaching there for 16 years and developed a number of classes, and really was a way for me to work through and create a lot of the theory and the model that I use now in my work. So it was one of those moments I was glad that I said yes, and turned out very well.
It's funny. I was 26 when Andrew Alexander, the owner of Second City and the guy behind SCTV, turned to me and asked me if I'd become the producer of Second City. And again, it was the same thing where I'm like, I can't, I'm completely not feeling qualified. I probably should say no. And I just didn't. I said, yes, and what's next kind of thing. And it didn't make life easy for the next couple of years. But, you know, I look back and like, if I had said no, you know, all this sort of richness that you know, came my way wouldn't have existed. And, you know, it's good. You've got to take those opportunities.
Absolutely. And it was such a beautiful example, too, of everything we've been talking about today, because in the early days of teaching, I would prepare, I would have notes, I would do, you know, everything, because I was worried that somehow I would be asked a question that I wasn't going to be able to answer. And how, of course, would that look if the professor couldn't answer the question? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I really trusted into what I knew, that, you know, it didn't matter if I couldn't answer something. We figured it out. We worked on it. We, you know, look at whatever it was. And it was in those places I was really the most effective in the classroom, was when I let go of that fear.
Yep. Ceding control. not always easy for people. Kathleen Schaefer, thank you so much for joining me. Kathleen, you can read about her. You can read her stuff. You can hire her and check her out at KathleenSchaefer.com. And this is Kelly Leonard. You've been listening to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. For more information on Second City Works, go to SecondCityWorks.com. Talk to you next week. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNPlus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.